thing, but I hope you're comfortable. And I look forward to presenting Mark Twain's A True Story. And I want to tell you a little bit about this story before we present it to you, and a little bit about some pertinent aspects of Mark Twain's life that I think may enhance your understanding of the story and the context in which he hears it and then publishes it. But first off, my thanks to the Elan Partnership for co-sponsoring this event, and they're doing so because of Mark Twain's friendship with Brother Church and his admiration for Church's paintings, especially a very large painting called The Spirit of the Andes. I think that's in the Metropolitan now, isn't it? Which Clemens saw as a young man. It was on a national tour. It went on a railroad tour. And he saw it in St. Louis. And he set about using a double negative. Not a single detail of this painting could be changed that I would not detect. He was extremely fond of it. He also, with Mrs. Clemens, visited Olana on at least one occasion in June 1887. And we know that they enjoyed a long weekend there, that they took some carriage tours around the property, that after dinner, he loved to speak even at someone else's house after dinner to occupy the airwaves. So he read from Robert Browning's poetry on that occasion. I think there's also a story of his hiding in the library when a tour of the property was going on, so he was going to go on that. In other words, we don't know the whole story, but we know some of it. But we know that there was a deep friendship there. We're in the middle of Mark Twain country. And I say that because even though I don't know whether he was in this building, he could have been. The building is old enough. But he lived all around us. He lived in Hartford, Connecticut. Fabulous. Tiffany Inspired House in Hartford is recently renovated and opened to the public. If you haven't been there, you like Mark Twain, that's a must visit. An easy day's drive. You could also go to the Wadsworth Athenaeum in Hartford and look at Frederick Church paintings on the same day. Mark Twain lived in Elmira for 20 summers, and that's where the story takes place, so that's why we want to talk a little bit about the Elmira connections first. And he lived in New York City, lived down on Fifth Avenue close to Washington Square. He lived in Tuxedo Park for several summers. I'm told, I haven't really gotten into this, that he spent a summer in Woodstock for that part of the Cascades, probably went to the Cascade Mountain House. So he was all around us. This is Mark Twain country in a very profound way. Even though he wrote not about this area so much as about his boyhood home in Missouri. The story occurs because Mark Twain married Olivia Langdon in 1870 in Elmira, New York. And the Langdon family had a summer home called Quarry Farm. And I have a little photo page that's circulating. And when it comes to you, there's a picture of Marianne Court, a picture of Mark Twain. Modest suggestion, Mark Twain, and but also pictures of the porch at Quarry Farm and of looking from the porch across the yard. So the story wouldn't have occurred if the Clemens family hadn't come to Quarry Farm for many years for summer vacation, usually June through August, for over 20 years. He was working on Tom Sawyer in 1874 when the story. Story of them occurs, and in subsequent years he worked on Huckleberry Finn, Connecticut Yankee, Pudd'nhead Wilson, Old Times in the Mississippi, all. I mean, he said this was his greatest writing place. The Langdons were a wealthy family. They were well-educated, refined, liberal in their political and religious views. They were abolitionists, they were suffragettes, supporters of women's suffrage. They had a station, their home was a station on the Underground Railroad, so that slaves coming through poverty. A very modest home in Hannibal, Missouri, in a slave state, of course. Slavery was never questioned in his childhood and growing up. It was supported by the schools, by the churches, by the law. His uncle owned slaves on a farm outside of Hannibal. And as a little boy, Sam Clemens played with slave children. And the slave children listened to old Uncle Dan tell Bible stories in the most dramatic way. Clemens, to me, one of the impressive things about him is that he must have had a phenomenal memory, and he used every material that came along. So Uncle Dan'l is his model for the runaway slave Jim in Huckleberry Finn. And some of the stories that Dan'l tells, point as a little boy, are stories that Jim tells Huck as, remember, it's flood time on the Mississippi, just as it is now, and Huck and Jim are making their way down the river. And Jim becomes something of a father figure to Huck. Well, that's Uncle Dan'l from St. Clement's childhood. At the age of 9, he had to leave school. His father died. His mother turned their home into a boarding house, and he worked for the local newspaper as a devil's, a printer's devil. He had to set type. He got his fingers wrapped every time he made a mistake in spelling or grammar. So he learned, even though he wasn't in school, he learned very good usage of the English language. And he vowed that he would not live in poverty, even though that was his condition in childhood. So he apprenticed with a Captain Horace Bixby on one of the great Mississippi River steamboats, and he learned the river trade. He wanted to be a pilot. That would be like being an American Airlines pilot today, I guess. Very well paid, high prestige. And he had the memory for it. But it was a challenge to this memory. He had to learn the river from St. Louis to New Orleans and back. He had to learn the river, he thought, you just have to do it in the daytime. No, you have to learn it at night, you have to learn it in fog, in flood stage, in drought, and it's a new river he discovered with each one of these different changes in condition. But he did that. He passed his exam, and he would have been probably not a writer, the writer that we know, but instead riverboat captain for his career. The Civil War intervened. He had only 2 years working on the river until navigation was closed, and soon after that he headed west, thinking, my brother is out there mining for silver. I think I'll follow him. So follow brother Orion to Silver City, Nevada, and began digging for silver. He didn't find silver. He managed to burn down a forest of trying to cut down trees for pit crops, and was kicked out of Silver City. So he went to the gold mining country of California, Calaveras County, and started panning for gold. But what he found was not gold. He was useless at finding rare metals. He found stories, nuggets of tales told around the mining camps. Tales like the celebrated jumping fry of Calaveras County and the Blue Jay Army, my grandfather's old ranch. Stories that he published in San Francisco newspapers, soon had column. He was soon doing stand-up comedic evenings in theaters in San Francisco, drawing some pretty big crowds. The Arctic papers picked up on the jumping fry story and others. So he was beginning to get a reputation back east. He was also meeting a number of Easterners who were abolitionists and who really changed his situation about race relations and about the evils of slavery. This was all important. By the time he met Olivia Langdon a year later when he came east, he still had not much money. He had small little reputation, but he had prospects. He had stories, he had a book well underway. I mean, it took him a year to convince the Langdon family that he was the right son-in-law for them, the right husband for Olivia. They were married in June in 1870, and this story takes place 4 years later. Well, okay, the coming
family starts coming back to Quarry Farm, and by 1874, they're a family of four. A little daughter, Susie, and Clara, who's just an infant, or maybe a toddler at that point. And they arrive to a big surprise, and that surprise is a new writing studio for Mark Twain. He looks at it, and it's the Texas deck of a steamship. It's the captain's wheelhouse. That the family had built for him, same proportions and dimensions, and it's in that studio that he wrote much of his best writing over the next 20 years. That was on a hillside just above the house in Quarry Farm, and so his habit there was to work in that studio during the mornings and into the afternoon, come down in the afternoon, spend some time with the family, have a wonderful dinner cooked by Marianne Court, whom he calls Aunt Rachel in the story. And this story that you're about to hear is a story she tells him. And all of the Mark Twain books, all the collections of his short stories, there's one story that stands out from all the others. It's not really a Mark Twain story, though it has his name on it, and that is this one. It's a true story, told just as I heard it by Mark Twain. And he's really being not the editor of it, a secretary, sort of like a secretary. He's telling a story that he heard. And I hope I've convinced you that he had developed by this point in his career a tremendously sharp ear for dialect, for the way in which people speak. And without prejudice, I think, you know, I think it was not a prejudicial class difference, but just an honest ear for how do people speak. How does Mrs. Cord, Aunt Rachel in the story, how does she tell the story? I want to capture all of that. The tone of speech, the nuances, the gestures, the emotions. And that's, of course, what he did. The family heard her tell the story. They were tremendously impressed. He started telling it on the talk circuit to others, and realized, I've got to share this with my wider audience. So he wrote it down and submitted the story to Atlantic Magazine. He had no success publishing Atlantic Monthly before this, but the editor was so impressed with it that they put it on a fast track for publication in November of 1874. So it tells you a little bit of background about how the story happened. What you haven't heard, of course, is the story. Summertime and twilight, we were sitting on the porch of the farmhouse on the summit of the hill, and Aunt Rachel was sitting respectfully below us on the steps. She was our servant and color. She was of a mighty frame and stature. She was 60 years old, but her eye was undimmed and her strength was unabated. She was cheerful, hearty. It was no more trouble for her to laugh than it is for a bird to sing. But she was under fire, as usual, because the day was over. And she was being teased without mercy, and she was enjoying it. She would let off peal after peal of laughter, and then sit with her face in her hands and shake with throes of enjoyment, which she could no longer get breath enough to express. At such a moment as this, a thought occurred to me, and I said to her, Aunt Rachel, how is it you have lived 60 years and had no trouble? She stopped quaking. She paused. And there was a moment of silence. She turned her face over her shoulder toward me, and she said, without even a smile in her voice.
Mr. Smith, is you in earnest?
It surprised me a good deal, and it sobered my manner of speech. I said, well, I thought so. But you can't have had any trouble. If you'd had trouble, I would have heard you sigh. I've never seen your eye when there wasn't a laugh in it. She faced fairly around and was in earnestness.
Has I had any trouble, Mr. C? I is going to tell you. Then I leave it to you. I was born down among the slaves. I know all about slavery. Because I've been one of them my own self. My old man, that's my husband. He was loving and kind to me. Just as kind as you is to your own wife. And we had children, 7 children. And we loved them children just the same as you love your children. They was black, but the Lord can't make no children so black, but their mother will love them and wouldn't get them up. No, not for anything in this whole world. Well, sir, I was raised in old Forgive. But my mother, she was raised in Maryland. And my soul, she was terrible when she gets started. She would clear that kitchen. and bandage up the child herself. So I said that word too when I went. Well, by and by, my old mistress says she's broke. And she got to sell all the niggers in the place. I grab him close to my chest. So Ann and I rise up and say, "You shouldn't take him away." And buy your freedom. Oh, bless the child. He always so good. But they got him. They got him. That man did. But I took and take till they closed. Most of them. And I beat them over the head with my chain. But they gave it to me too. But I didn't mind that. Well, that was my old man gone. All my children, all my 7 children, and 6 of them, I ain't set eyes on again to this day. And that's 22 years ago, last Easter. The man that bought me belonged in Newburgh. And he took me there. Well, by and by, and they walk on. My master, he was a Confederate colonel. To run away, he would make it to the north. So one day, I comes in there where the big officers were, and the bar. And I dropped the coach. So, and I told them about my anger. They listened to my troubles just the same as if I was white folks. And I said, what I come for is because if you got away, and got up north, where your gentleman comes from. You might have seen him. Maybe. And the coach told me so. I have to find him again. He was very there. And had his heart in his waist. And at the top of his forehead. He won't be there no more now. He's a man. I never thought of that before. He was only that little fella to me yet. I never thought about him growing up and being big. today. None of the gentlemen had one person. So they couldn't do nothing for me. But all that time, though I didn't know it, my enemy was going off to the north. Years and years. And he was a barber. And he worked for himself. And by me God, when the war comes, he ups and he says, I don't bother. He says, I just want to find my old man. Less than she's dead. So he sold out and went to war the work he couldn't and hired himself out to the colonel for his servant. And then he went all for bad, everywhere, hunting for his old man. Yes, indeed. He hired to first one officer and then another. Till he's ransacked the whole South. But you see, I didn't know it. I didn't know about this. How was I going to know about it? Well, one night, we had a big soldier ball. The soldier there at Newburgh was always having ball and carrying on. They had him in my kitchen. He was there. Because it was so big. I knew I was down on such tools because my place was in the office. And he asked me, two of them common soldiers around my kitchen like that. But I always stood around and kept things straight. I did. And sometimes they get my dander up. And then I make them clear that kitchen. Mind I tell you. Well, one night, it was a Friday night. They come a whole platoon from a neighbor regiment that was on guard at the house. The house was headquarters, you know. And then I was just a bit mad. I swelled them out and swelled them out. I was just itching for them to do something for society. And there was a blazing and a dancing. And there was waltzing and dancing around. They was having a time. And I just a sweat. And a sweat. Pretty soon, long comes such a spruce up. and making fun. In the house instance, get along with you, my bitch. The young man's face kind of changed. All of a sudden, about a second, then he went on smiling again, same as he was before. Well, about this time, in comes some niggas that play music and play in the band. And they never could get along about putting on airs. And the very first air they put on that night, I lay on them. They laughed, and that made me worse. The rest of the niggas got to laughing. And then my soul alive. I was hot. My eye was just a blazing. I just stretched myself up, just as I is now. So just eyes to the ceiling. And I danced my fist on my hips. And I said, look at here. I said, I want you damn niggas to understand that. I wasn't born in the mash to be fooled by trash. I'm one of the old blue hen chickens. I is. I see that young man's face is tearing and stiff, looking at her up at the ceiling, like he forgot something, he couldn't remember no more. Well, I just march on them niggas, so looking like a gent, and they just came away before me, out at the door. And as this young man was going out, I hear him say to another nigga, Jim, you go along and tell the captain I'll be on hand at 8 o'clock in the morning. There's something on my mind. I don't sleep no more this night. You go along, he says, and leave me by my own self. This one about 1 o'clock in the morning. Well, about 7, I was up and on hand, getting the officer's breakfast. I was stooping down the stove, just so, as I, your foot was the stove. And I opened the stove with my right hand. So I pushed it down by the stove, just so. And I just cut the pan of cut the stove in my hand. And was about to raise up. When I see a black face come along on the mind, and the eyes are looking up to mine, eyes, looking eyes, your eyes now. And just so up close.
If you have any questions or comments, we'd be glad to entertain them for a few minutes.